Colossians 2:11-2:17, the eighth talk in a series on Colossians, was presented by Ron Julian on September 5, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We are back in the book of Colossians. When you take on the task of teaching a book, as opposed to doing something thematic, if you're doing something thematic, you can pick those passages that you feel really comfortable with and kind of dance around to those. When you go through a book, you have to go through the whole thing, and that means sometimes going through some really tough parts, and that's where we are today. From my perspective, the section that we're talking about today in Colossians is rather difficult. It has a lot of interpretive questions involved with it. And I'm still in the process of trying to sort some of those out. Some of them are issues that I have been thinking about for years. Jack and I have had, we've been doing the radio show up in Albany for like 7 years together, and over that period of time, I can remember a number of occasions driving back and forth and arguing about the issues involved in passages like this. So I'm still in the process of trying to put some of those things together, which makes it challenging to talk to you about it. It would be challenging even if I weren't in that situation, because there are a lot of little details in this section, and you face this question: how many of these details am I going to talk about? If I talk about them all, I risk sort of drowning you in this avalanche of facts. If I don't talk about them, I risk sort of leaving you in the dust. Well, what about that phrase, and what did he do with that, and what did he do with that? So what I'm going to try to do is I want to start by sort of giving you what I think is the big picture. This is what I understand Paul to be doing, basically, in the verses that are coming up here. And then I'm going to look selectively at some details along the way and tell you about some of the interpretive issues. And I invite you to pay close attention and ask any questions that you might have at the end. I know I'm not going to be hitting on everything. So let me step back and tell you what I think is the big picture, the thing that ties this together and makes sense before we actually start to look at it. I see Paul addressing sort of the perennial battle between what we might call religion and faith. On the one hand, the Colossians have started to listen to what Paul calls the teachings and commandments of men. And we see some examples. He uses language like do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. Observe this festival, observe this Sabbath. These are the kinds of issues that they're confronting. That somehow some sort of a system has been set up in opposition to, whether explicitly or implicitly, in opposition to the gospel. Here is another way of thinking about things. Here's what God wants you to do. He wants you to live an ascetic life. You should restrict your eating and drinking in certain ways. You should observe these festivals. And Sabbaths and things like that, of course, are all about not doing things. You're supposed to discipline your body, keep yourself free from certain foods and certain drinks and certain activities and so on. The people are advocating these things and defending them by appealing to visions and to the worship of angels. At least that seems to be implied in what Paul is talking about. That somehow this group is defending a certain set of religious disciplines as essential in one's relationship with God and defending them by appealing to visions, angelic visions or something like that. We don't, all we know of the details is sort of what peeks out in what Paul says to them. Here's what he's addressing, and so the problem must be something like that. On the other hand, Paul is setting up in opposition to this set of ideas and practices, faith in Christ. Paul sees that as fundamentally incompatible with this set of regulations and religious practices that they are embracing, seemingly in as an alternative to the gospel. So, what's the problem? What is it that Paul is trying to tell them here in this section? When it all comes down to it, what is the issue? Well, so far, here's how I would describe the issue. And I emphasize again that I am in process trying to understand what this is about, and I am open to being argued out of this, as I, of course, should be. But here's the problem as I understand it. First of all, these religious restrictions, religious regulations, hold out the promise of being the way to please God, but in fact, they are not. I mean, why is it that we would take on a set of religious regulations? I'm going to observe rituals and eating rituals and festivals and those sorts of things. It's because I think such behavior marks me as one of the good guys. Such behavior marks me as one who is pleasing to God. But the fact is that it's a false promise that these regulations are holding out. I do not become acceptable to God by observing certain ascetic practices regarding my eating and keeping Sabbaths and those sorts of things. That's not how you arrive at God's favor. Okay, furthermore, these religious regulations and restrictions hold out the promise of being the solution to my problem as a sinner. Now, I think the way that that would happen is that basically, if you picture it, although we're not necessarily dealing with Pharisees here, what does every good Pharisee tell himself? Yeah, I can remember back to when I used to be wild and profligate and I did all kinds of crazy stuff, but now, boy, I'm keeping the rules. Now I know what it is that's required. You won't find me neglecting to tithe that dill and mint and cumin. I'm in there doing it. Well, so not only does keeping these regulations offer the hope of commending me to God, but I can picture myself then as one who has gotten it together. One whose life is now regulated and orderly and in keeping with the way things ought to be. And so, as opposed to those out there in the world who are just eating anything they want and not observing these days and so on, I know that I'm on the right path. And so, I've become one of the good ones. Hey, you know, my body gets me in all kinds of trouble, right? I mean, that's the source of my sin, is my body. So I'm not going to give it everything it wants to eat. I'm going to have days where I insist that my body not do everything that it might want to do. And so in doing that, I have regulated myself. I have gotten my life in order. And so I have moved from being a person who was uninterested in what is right to now I'm a person who's in there doing what's right. But the problem is that these regulations don't really deal with the problem of human sin at all. My problem as a sinner is not solved if I take on these restrictions. I can take on the rituals and the regulations. I can limit what I eat. I can limit what I do on certain days. But it doesn't really solve the problem. Now, there can be a place for religious regulations. I mean, we don't want to forget that God himself asked of the Israelites, as a part of the covenant he made with them, that they keep certain religious regulations. He restricted what they could eat. He set aside days that they were supposed to observe. But part of the ongoing process of coming to understand God was to see that he gave those regulations not because in and of themselves they were the essence of what he wanted human life to be, and not because if you did all of those things then you would be justified before him, that that's all he expected. What he was looking from people was people who ate the right stuff and did the right stuff on the right days. That's not the essence of what he was looking for. Those regulations were there to point ahead to something else. They were there to point the way to what God was really interested in. They were a way of taking parts of my life and making them educational, making me stop and think, now wait a minute, what's life really about? And as it's true with anything, what was intended to be educational in some lives ended up being a replacement for the thing that it was pointing to. The regulations and rituals, instead of pointing to something more important beyond themselves, became the be-all and the end-all for some people. Because, again, if I do these things, then I know that I'm okay. There is a place for the rituals, for the restrictions and the requirements in the religious life. God made a place for them. But Paul, as I understand it in this section, refers to them as the elementary sorts of things. It's like the kindergarten stuff. Okay, yeah, every pagan out there has gotten the idea that if there are, as a god or gods out there to deal with, that there are certain things that I try to do to please the powers that be. But that's not at the heart of what a relationship with God is all about. There's something else at the heart of that. And what Paul sees as being at the heart of that relationship is what Christ has done for us on the cross. The scandal is that the Colossians are abandoning Jesus, who is the real thing. He has come to bring about the reality that all of those rituals were pointing to. They're abandoning the real thing and embracing what Paul calls the shadow. It's that preliminary thing that wasn't what it was all about. It was just pointing to what it was all about. Jesus is what it is all about, and yet somehow they think that they're making an advance by letting go of their grip on the truths of the gospel and embracing this set of religious practices and restrictions instead. What's so important about the gospel, and Paul has been emphasizing this already in what we've seen in the letter several times, it's central to what he sees life to be about. The gospel tells us about the real solution to our problems. First of all, how can I find the favor of God? Am I going to find the favor of God by practicing certain religious rituals? No. The favor of God has been won by what Jesus did on the cross. That's what Paul keeps saying. He hasn't used the word justification, but that's what he's been talking about throughout, is that I have been reconciled to God. If I have put my faith in Jesus, then my sins, which are real and are many, are not being held against me. I am guilty and condemned before God. That's a reality. If nothing happens to change that, I am lost. There is not one single thing in this world that I can do to save myself. I can't do it with money. I can't do it with possessions. I can't do it with religious practices. I can't do it through philanthropy. There isn't a single thing that I can do to save myself from the destruction that I have brought upon myself. There is nothing. That's why the gospel is such great news, because it is the story of God reaching out and reconciling me to himself. God taking the initiative to overcome the barrier that my guilt is between us. That's the first thing. Those religious rituals do not commend me to God, but what Christ did on the cross does. And that's the first thing that Paul wants to get across, is this is the only thing that can solve the real problem of my alienation from God. I can't do it through religious practices. Secondly, What Christ has done on the cross is the real solution to the problem of my sin. Not just my guilt, but the reality of the moral corruption that I find in me. I can set up 157,000 different religious regulations, but I can't really solve the problem of my own heart. It's just not going to happen. But what Jesus did on the cross reconciles me to God so that now God and His power and His life is at work in me, healing me, drawing me out of the corruption that is in this world, the corruption that is in myself. So, when it all comes down to it now, what Paul is trying to get across to them is, what you have in the gospel is a proclamation of how, through what Christ did on the cross, if you will embrace it and put your faith in Him and hold fast to that story, you find reconciliation with God and then freedom ultimately from the problem of sin and ultimately of death. Things are made right between God and myself so that things can be made right in my life. That's the gospel. What you Colossians are doing are turning away from that instead. I mean, some of the Colossians are at least tempted to do so, are turning away from that to a system of asceticism and religious regulations that can't really bring you into favor with God and doesn't really solve the problem of evil in your life. You may think that you're living a well-regulated life that is pleasing to God, but in fact it is neither well-regulated nor pleasing to God. It is neither of those things. That's the classic problem with all sorts of religious systems and appeals to legalism of one kind or another, is that the appeal of it is that it says to me, I'm doing it right, and therefore God is pleased with me. Whereas, in fact, I am neither doing it right, nor is God pleased with me. I have taken the substance, the reality, and put it aside, and I'm just embracing the shadows. That's what I understand the issue to be in Colossians. That's what I think Paul is trying to get across, is do you want to be right with God and to have things made right for yourself? Then hold fast to the gospel. Don't listen to this stuff that you're hearing from these other folks, because it can't do it. It won't do it. It's a lie. That's what I understand him to be saying. Now, let's see if we can go through it a little bit and see if I can show you somewhat of what I see going on here. It's tricky. Bear with me. We'll go back and start with... Let's go back to verse 8. We talked a little bit about this last time, but let me... Oh, in chapter 2, excuse me. Chapter 2 of Colossians, verse 8. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. For in Him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in Him you have been filled or fulfilled. So, this is the starting point for the big exhortation in the book of Colossians. See that to it that no one takes you captive. They're out there trying, like pirates out on a raid, trying to get you for themselves. Don't let them do it. And he says, don't be deceived by the traditions of men. That's what they've been listening to, this system that they're tempted to embrace. Paul is calling it the traditions of men. This is not from God. This is not what God is telling you to do. This is a set of regulations that men have decided make sense and make life what it ought to be. He makes this comment about the fullness of deity, and in Him you have been fulfilled. And as I've been arguing in past weeks, the thrust of those statements, I think, is that We are to see all of God in Christ. And if we stick with him, then everything, all fulfillment, all filling and fullness, everything we need will be ours. As opposed to the idea that somehow there is something else to be found beyond Christ. Maybe I can learn a little more about God from this other person. Jesus had some good things to say, but this other teacher, he's got some great stuff that I need to listen to too. He emphasized more how I need to not eat this stuff and follow these regulations, and that makes sense to me. If I do that, then God will really be pleased with me. So, that's where I'm going to get some more stuff. Maybe Jesus didn't quite have it all together. But Paul's emphasis is, no, you can't go anywhere else. All of God is found in him, and all fulfillment is found in him. Everything that is needed to fill and make full a life is to be found in connection with him. And then he says, and he is the head over all rule and authority. How can I get this across? Think about it like this. We can treat a passage like this as a series of disconnected little statements. Oh, here's a theological tidbit about the divinity of Christ, and here's a theological tidbit about the eternal realms, and we go through sort of mining it for pieces that we can put in our systematic theology. This is a very common way to deal with the Bible. I think it is the wrong way to deal with the Bible. What we're trying to find is the connection, the thread that ties all these things together, so that we can see what is the issue that Paul's addressing and how is he using this particular piece. Well, he says here he is the head over all rule and authority. I think it's interesting that later on Paul talks about how Jesus disarmed the rulers and authorities. He's using that phrase again. I think that it is significant in this argument that Paul is making. It plays a role. The idea that Jesus trumps the rulers and authorities, that he is the head over them, that he has defeated them. Now, what is that all about? Most people argue that the rulers and authorities that Paul refers to are heavenly powers, that the Colossians in their system have made an appeal to some understood system of heavenly powers and authorities that have dictated the way they're behaving. In support of that, we could see the language that he uses later on about people who take their stand on visions that they have seen and the worship of angels. In that way of thinking about it, then, the Colossians have this idea that there are these set of practices that we need to obey, and it is the heavenly powers up there, the angels, the hierarchy of angels and powers and so on, that are telling us that we ought to do this. It seems to me possible as well, though, that even though he does talk about angels and visions and so on later on, that when Paul talks about the rulers and authorities, that he might have in mind earthly leaders and authorities as well. Because obviously there is a system here of practices. He calls it the traditions of men. There are a set of practices here about what you eat and what days you observe and so on that are being commanded by a set of teachers, a group of people who have set themselves up as authorities and are saying this is the way it ought to be. So whichever way we take it, whether we see the rulers and authorities as being heavenly or earthly, and I'm still kind of trying to sort that out, what is true is that Jesus is the head over them. He has triumphed over them. As we're going to see a little later, what he did on the cross brought about his victory. It put him as head over all rule and authority. There is no one that you can go to and said, but he said to do this. because every rule and authority is subject to Christ. There are authorities like Paul, who says, and I believe him, that he is speaking with the authority of Jesus, that Jesus has taught him, and the message that he is proclaiming is Jesus' message. That's why we accept it. Not because of Paul's authority, but because of Jesus' authority. And then there are those, like myself, who get up and teach about various passages in the Bible and tell us we ought to believe this and do such and so. And you understand, I hope, that I have no authority in the sense that just because I say it means that it's true, or just because I say it means that you ought to do it. Again, whatever authority there is in what I'm saying resides in the teaching of Jesus. If I have understood what Paul is saying, and if Paul is speaking the truth ratified by Jesus himself, then you don't have the option of ignoring what I have to say. But, of course, the big gap that has to be overcome is, am I getting it right? Am I telling you what it is that Paul was saying? So I need to be put under the utmost scrutiny. Is that right? Is this really, in fact, what it is that Paul said? Ultimately, the authority always comes back to Jesus. If you can demonstrate to yourself that you think Jesus was saying something different than what I'm saying, then you ought to believe him and not me. And then there are those who just claim to have authority from God or from angels or from spirits who lived in the past or whatever. And Paul is basically saying they're wrong. That authority is not theirs. There is only one ultimate authority, and it's Jesus. So when he says he is the head over all rule and authority, this is, as I understand it, this is not just an abstract statement. What would I mean by abstract? It's not just a theological statement that he felt like he needed to make so that his systematic theology would be complete. He's speaking into a situation. Here are people who are listening to authorities. And he's saying, well, you know, actually, as it happens, you may remember that there is one authority. He's over all of them. He outranks them all. Okay. Now it starts to get tricky. And in him you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in the removal of the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. Let me start there. Obviously, Paul has in mind a metaphorical sort of circumcision. He uses this language, the Bible uses this language in a variety of ways. We can go all the way back to Moses, who talked about, I'm right about this, aren't I? He talked about the circumcision of the heart. Certainly in the Old Testament that language is found, and Paul picks it up again in Romans. The idea that whereas there is an outer physical ritual that involves the cutting away of some skin, but now we're talking about another reality where God is cutting away something that needs to be taken away. So there's some picture of Christ bringing about a circumcision in our lives. So we want to try to understand what that is. What is it that is being cut away? Now, he talks about this circumcision made without hands. You can see the importance of that. It's not an outward physical act that I could do to someone. It is an inner spiritual reality of some sort that he's describing that only God could do. I wonder whether Paul has chosen the language circumcised with a circumcision made without hands to emphasize the reality of what Christ has done, the spiritual importance of what Christ has done, as opposed to the circumcision that is done with hands. In which case it would suggest that perhaps, I mean, it's all very difficult to put together, but perhaps the people that he's writing to, that this system of regulations, the ascetic regulations that they're following, have a Jewish root to them. Later on, he talks about, let no one be your judge regarding Sabbaths. And there's another sort of Jewish-sounding ritual that he may be referring to. So it's possible. I just have not decided yet. But it's possible that the problem that he's dealing with is not just a set of religious regulations, but it has in it its roots in the Jewish law. That is at least possible in the situation. And so notice then how he's emphasizing here, no, there is a circumcision brought about without hands. This is the real deal. Why would you worry about these other external things when what Christ is doing brings about the internal reality that we're looking for? Now, uses this phrase, in the removal of the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. This is a difficult phrase to get a hold of, and people make all sorts of arguments for many options as to how you might take it. I'm inclined to see it in connection with what Paul says as we go through this. The body shows up in a number of places throughout this section. In particular, let me, at the very end of chapter 2, let me read you verse 23. These are matters which have, to be sure, the appearance of wisdom in self-made religion and self-abasement and severe treatment of the body, but are of no value against fleshly indulgence. So the idea that somehow by dealing with their body in a certain way, they have dealt with the flesh, with the problem of the flesh, the problem of the innate sinfulness in the human being. Paul's saying, it's not true. Okay, yeah, you've been severe with your body. You've limited what you can eat, and you've disciplined your body in various ways. But it is of no real value against the flesh. It doesn't really work with the problem that the flesh represents. Here, Paul is talking about a circumcision, which is the removal of the body of the flesh. So it's a little difficult to put together, but I'm inclined to think that he has something in mind here about the ultimate solution to the problem of the flesh. It is a circumcision where instead of physical flesh being cut away, it is the problem that my body of flesh represents that has been cut away. That what Jesus is doing is cutting out the diseased flesh that has corrupted and tainted my life and is making me whole. That's the direction that my thinking is going right now. There are a lot of issues involved in that. So we have some reality that he's talking about here, that he's describing in terms of this circumcision that Jesus is bringing about. Well, can we get any more specific about what's involved with that? We can, but it's going to get even trickier as we go along to do that. Let's read on in verse 12. Having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised up with him through faith in the working of God, who raised him from the dead. And when you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of death, of debt, consisting of decrees against us, and which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. Okay. A lot of tricky little issues here. The overall idea, I think, is relatively clear. I think it is. Christ's death on the cross frees us from guilt and makes us alive. Now, this is a hard section. And as I say, in this section, we come across some things that I've been wrestling with for a long time. Jack and I can argue about it afterwards, I guess. Let me tell you as much as I can understand of what's going on here. I think that Paul is building his metaphors here, this picture of, okay, I'm buried with Jesus, I'm raised up with Jesus, that sort of language. Here are the realities that are fueling this language. Paul sees me as a human being, as being, in a sense, dead in my sins. I am guilty and cut off from God. And so I am cut off from the source of life. And the life that I'm living in this world is a kind of death in life. Life is not really what it ought to be because I am cut off from the source of life. And I stand condemned. It is only a matter of time until I am destroyed eternally. The second death comes upon me, and I die the death that you never recover from. So I'm dead. My sins have me dead. What was the solution to that situation? As an offering for my sins, Jesus died and rose again. So he died, and then he lived, and he lives today, and will live forever. So, Jesus' death and resurrection into life is the solution to my problem of being dead and entering into life. He takes me out of death, and he brings me into life. So there is this parallelism there. Jesus died and rose again. I was dead and am brought to new life. Paul plays with that relationship in his language. You can see how it would make sense that he would do so. I'm dead, but if I die with him, his death on the cross, then I'm raised with him. I enter into new life. Now, obviously, there's a difference. Jesus physically died and rose again into new life. The death that he's talking about, I'm dead in a different sense. I die with him in a different sense, and I'm raised again in a different sense. Ultimately, I am raised to new life in the resurrection. But he's talking about something that's happened now. I have been made alive. Somehow, in a sense, I was dead and now I'm alive. And I think the reality is I was dead in my guilt, in my being cut off from the source of life, and in my condemnation. And now all of that has been solved. My guilt has been solved. And so I have a new relationship with God, where I have access to life. The God of the universe is at work imparting life to me, and I will not be condemned in the end. So everything about me that was dead now is coming to life through what Jesus did. When I put my faith in him, identify with him, then the power of his death solves my problem, and I enter into life. That's the reality that Paul's talking about. His death solves the problem of my death. He lives and gives me new life. How do we put the details together here? In the past, I have been inclined to think that when Paul uses language like, I was buried with him in baptism, another place he says, I was crucified with Christ. There are other places where he talks about dying with Christ and then living again. There are a handful of passages that use this idea. In the past, I have been inclined to think that what Paul is talking about is that idea of the substitutionary atonement. His death was my death. So I died with him in the sense that when he died, in a very real sense, it was my death. God was counting his death to me. And then his resurrection into new life, he lives to give me life. And that may be what he has in mind. I know that last time I talked to Jack, he was inclined in some other passages that talk about this stuff to see my death with Christ as being more my personal embracing of the death of Jesus as the solution to my problem. So I die with Christ by looking at his death and saying, yes, that's what I needed, was someone to make the offering for my sin. Again, it's tricky. But you can see, however we explain the language down to the details of why exactly is he using that language, what he's saying is pretty clear. I am dead in my sins and trespasses. I have sinned against God. I am guilty. I am cut off from his life. I stand condemned. What Jesus has done on the cross has brought about a situation where now I am reconciled to God. Now it is as if I died with him and am living with him. Through his death, my situation has changed. I have been justified, and that's at the root of it. Because he died, I am right with God. And then because he died, and because I am right with God, now things are new for me. I am forgiven, I am redeemed, and the life of God is at work in me. That's the situation. You can see, I hope, clearly in this language, that the issue is my guilt before the law, this picture of the certificate of death, which has been nailed to the cross and set aside. Jesus' death has taken care of the charge against me, something like that he's saying. And then he again makes the statement, when he had disarmed the rulers and authorities, he made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him. Again, Paul mentions the rulers and authorities. Whether heavenly or earthly powers, they were defeated at the cross of Christ. As he said before, Christ is head over them. Paul pictures their public humiliation, the triumphal victory procession where the general leads his captives, and they come behind in shame and defeat. Why the strong language here? Why is he even saying that? It seems in a way like jumping out into left field. I mean, we're talking about Jesus taking care of the certificate of debt against us, and now we're talking about him having disarmed the rulers and authorities. But, see, I think all of these things go together. Remember the Colossians, at least I understand at this point, the Colossians to have this idea that they have this set of commandments and practices that they would defend as being a part of the order of things, and they would appeal to their authorities for the justification for why they ought to do them. But in essence, what Jesus has done at the cross has made himself head over all things and established the way to life. He is the head over all rule and authority, partly because he is the only source of life. Where are you going to go? What set of commandments out there in the world from angels or teachers or anybody are you going to follow that's going to lead you to life? It's not going to happen because Christ and what he did on the cross is the only source of life. He made things right with God, and he therefore made it possible for me to be transformed, to be changed. That's the reality. And so then he goes on to say, therefore let no one act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. All of this is tied together somehow is what I'm trying to package. He says, therefore let no one act as your judge in regard to these commands, these traditions of men, these ascetic practices that you're being commanded to do. That kind of stuff is the shadow. It's a shadow of what is to come. In the Old Testament, when God gave restrictions regarding eating and so on, as I said before, those things were just shadowy pointers to the reality of what Jesus did. Jesus is the one who has brought about what the reality that we're looking for. Now, it's an interesting phrase. New American Standard translates this, things which are a shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. I just point out to you that literally the language here is, things which are a shadow of what is to come, but the body is of Christ. You can see why in this context it might be, it's at least interesting that he would use that language. You can see New American Standard, I think a very fine option for interpreting this would, they're contrasting shadow and body, saying, like, picture, here's my body casting the shadow on the ground. The shadow is not the reality, the body is the reality. So when they translate it, the substance belongs to Christ, that's fine. That they're understanding him to be talking about the shadow versus the reality. And that may very well be what's going on. But it is interesting that he uses the language, the body, here. And it seems possible to me that literally what he is saying is the body belongs to Christ, and that what he's getting at here is the way we use our body. The issue is the ascetic practices here. What I do with my body is being, both what I allow myself to do and what I restrict myself should not be controlled by these ascetic practices which these traditions of men are imposing on them, but the body and what it does, what it is free to do and what it should not do, it belongs to Christ, and he is the one who determines what that's about. That seems at least possible to me. Now, there's more to say about some of those things, but I'd like to stop here and give us a chance to catch our breath and ask some questions. I realize that this has been somewhat muddled because I am still trying to put this together in my own head. I hope that the overall picture is clear enough so that you can at least critique it as we're going along and see whether you think ultimately it makes sense. So I really would invite any questions or comments. I don't want to put you on the spot, Jack, but I know some of these issues are things we've talked about before. If you've got anything you want to add to that stuff, feel free. Anything. It's so incredibly vague what I said that you couldn't possibly think of a question to ask. How can you ask a question about fog, you ask yourself?
The stuff you've been talking about is real relevant to the discussions I've been having with through email with a group of mostly Catholics, but some Protestants, and Protestants leading towards Catholicism. And we haven't gotten quite into the depth as yet as to the value of religious practices. But one of the things that has come up is the question of what constitutes a religious practice. I was referring to the Eucharist as the Holy Communion as a religious practice, and someone took issue with, well, why do you call it a religious practice? And I was, it was one of those things I always felt it was obvious, so I never articulated to myself. And I was wondering if you could define for me what you think is a religious, what do you mean by a religious practice, and what would be valid reasons as opposed to invalid reasons to engage in a religious practice?
Okay, well, I think we could use the language variously, actually, depending on what the question is. You know, it's kind of as opposed to what kind of situation. By religious practice, first of all, I don't necessarily mean that as a term of disdain or, you know, that's the bad stuff or something like that. Typically, when I use the term, what seems to be to me to be most significant as we try to sort this stuff out is, are the things that I am called upon to do intrinsically worth doing, or do they find their value in some externally imposed situation? Let me describe what I mean. The classic one, I use this one all the time, but it's so striking to me. When we go back into Leviticus, two verses, one next to the other. The first one talks about loving your neighbor as yourself. The next one says not to mix two kinds of fabrics together when you get dressed. Now, both of them are commands. Both of them are a part of the covenant that God made with Israel. But the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself, not just Jesus, but even the thoughtful Jews, the Pharisees, the rabbis of Jesus' time, would ask the question, what are the great commandments? What are the commandments that sort of stand above the others? And some of them recognized and would have said, love your neighbor as yourself is one of those. And I think at least what I would mean by calling it a great commandment is it is appealing to a fundamental principle about the way things are and the way things ought to be that is germane in every situation. I am always called upon to love my neighbor as myself. It is applied variously, but I wouldn't call loving my neighbor as myself a religious practice in the way that I would use the word. The commandment against mixing two kinds of fabrics, I think, is a religious practice. It is not that it is intrinsically wrong, that there is something in the nature of things that is wrong about mixing two kinds of fabrics when you get dressed. I suppose there are certain fabrics that some of us would hope that people wouldn't mix when they're, you know, sort of plaid and polka dot or something like that. But basically, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with doing that. But it's not that God was wrong to command that, or that somebody could look at that commandment and say, oh, I won't bother with that. The issue is, what is the context in which I'm being commanded to do that? I think it's intended to be educational. I think the idea has something to do with holiness, the idea that we do not want to, the distinction that this is one thing and this is another thing is one that in the spiritual level, on the level of reality, it is absolutely essential that we not lose that distinction. You know, this is dark and this is light and they're not the same thing, you know, that kind of thing. And so I'm thinking that the commandment against mixing two kinds of fabrics is, you know, it says something about holiness, about purity. You go, oh, no, I can't wear that because these two need to be the same. And it just gets you thinking a little bit about what would be behind that. So it's a religious practice in the sense that the religion that I am a part of calls upon me to do it. But if I were not obligated out of some covenantal religious relationship with God in that spot, I would pay no mind to it. I would do it or not do it as I saw fit, because it's not intrinsically right. So if that were the kind of language that that in your discussion was being used, I could see that someone might mean, see, they would use the language religious practice for the mixing of two fabrics together, but they would say the Eucharist is not a religious practice. The Eucharist is an elemental part of reality. It is a means of grace. It is wired into the very nature of things. It's not that you can do it or not do it as you see fit. That is the means of grace, and if you do not partake of it, you will not get it. So that's not a religious practice. That is something that is intrinsically valuable in and of itself. Now, that's the kind of distinction that makes the most sense to me in that kind of context. You could call the Eucharist a religious practice. You still have not, what you're saying as a Protestant, and most Protestants would call the Eucharist a religious practice. Some would call it a sacrament. But even so, I think most of us, at least a lot of us, would say, okay, this is something that is, it's not that it had to be that way, and all other things being equal, I could pass it by. But am I in the situation like the Jew was with the fabrics? Am I in a relationship with God as a Christian where I have been commanded to observe certain religious practices? So I could say that the Eucharist was a religious practice but I'm still obligated to do it, not because there's something intrinsic in it of itself, but because I have been commanded to do it and I want to be obedient. So it could be a religious practice that I am free to disregard because I understand, you know, it's like David's eating the showbread. I have gotten to the point where I understand the point of it such that I'm free to violate it because it has served its purpose. Or, essentially, no, it is a religious practice that I have been commanded to keep and I feel like I ought to keep it. But it wouldn't surprise me that a Catholic would see of the Eucharist not as a religious practice, but actually as an intrinsic good. Not just that I've been commanded to do it, but, you know, it's like you're in the middle of the desert, and I say, you know, do you need to be commanded to go to that tap over there and turn on the water? I mean, if you don't, you will die. So it's not so much a religious practice as a requirement of reality. Jack?
Just two unrelated things. It was interesting to me, with regard to the line of questioning and the debate that Margaret is having. Maybe you know what a Catholic would say about this, but you couldn't get any more basic a religious practice than circumcision in the Old Covenant in the life of Israel, and yet he's very clearly not taking a sacramental view of circumcision. I mean, his whole point of a circumcision made without hands is that he's not conceding anything to the physical act in terms of being the way in which God's grace is channeled to people or something like that.
Right.
That the reality is something that happens independently of any physical act whatsoever. So he's taking a very non-sacramental view of circumcision.
Romans 2, the same thing.
Romans 2, there. Yeah. So I'd be curious as to what Roman Catholic theology does with that. I mean, did God only become a sacramentalist when Jesus came to earth? I mean, that's when he became a sacramentalist, and before that he hadn't thought of it yet, or what are we doing here? I mean, that just seems like a very strange problem.
Yeah, I do have an answer to that question.
You do? Okay.
Yeah, okay, so.
And then the second thing that occurs to me is, you'll get here, but I like the direction of your thinking in terms of seeing these rulers and authorities as religious authorities, religious teachers, and so on. The only thing that would tend to go against that is the use of angels later.
Right.
But I can readily see him, either by their own elevating themselves to the view of spokesman for God,
right,
using the word angel to describe them. They might even describe themselves along those lines, where they don't really mean a super metaphysical being, but they just simply mean someone who has a message from God by way of these visions or otherwise. They have the authority because God has given them the authority to speak for them. And the point that he's making is that these authorities who are teaching you to go back and obey the law, the problem is they've been trumped by Jesus. Jesus didn't teach that.
Right.
And he has more authority than they do. Along
right.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Right. And there is kind of a middle ground there. The authorities could be basing their appeal, their own authority, on visions that involve actual angels, you know, that I am visitations or that kind of thing. With your first one, yes. Right. Well, the question is how I'm using the word sacrament. That's a really hard question because what I'm trying to do, it's not a word that I use in my own vocabulary much. I'm trying to pick up on other people's vocabulary and understand what it is that they're doing. So I am not particularly a sacramentalist myself, as I understand what that word means. I know what Reformed theology, at least I sort of know what Reformed theology does with that first issue that you were talking about, Jack, because remember, see, they kind of turn that argument on its head. Because in here, we talk about being buried with him in baptism, and their argument is that, in essence, circumcision was a sacrament in the Old Testament, which has been replaced by the sacrament of baptism. That what circumcision was in the Old Testament, baptism is in the New. But you're right, it's a strange sort of picture, because we come along, we have this sacrament of circumcision, which is replaced when Jesus comes along, and now Paul is dumping on it and saying, you know, can't do anything, it's just external, and it doesn't... Somehow, that argument, his argument, doesn't seem to really hold up very much if it was a sacrament back then, it was just as external back then as it is now. So, yeah, so I would still tend to agree with you. But that's the move that's usually made, I think, and maybe in, for Catholic theology too, I don't know. Okay, well, we'll come to the end. Let me just emphasize to you what I want you to take away from this. I mean, I know justification and that kind of stuff is like old hat a million times Christian stuff, but that's what the story is about. The whole issue is, how do you get right with God? And they're offering up a system where, hey, do this stuff and you'll be right with God, and the blessings will come. What Paul is saying is, God did the thing that makes us right with Him. The scandal is, it's not my obedience and my behavior and my set of rules, it's not that that is bringing about my being in God's favor. It is the offering of Jesus on the cross and the work of God in my life. And if I turn away from that for something else, I'm embracing something with no substance. And I'm turning away from the only thing in the world that has real substance. It's like, you know, I won't try to make up anything, that's right. But the fact is, you know, you want the real thing. You want something that when all is said and done does not evaporate and melt away, but is something substantial that you can have forever. What Christ did on the cross, believing that story, embracing it, and holding on to it as your hope, that's the only way to grab a hold of something real. That's what Paul is trying to tell him. And that, if you find that boring, I mean, I'm sure that I can be boring, but that is not boring. If you think it is, you haven't quite understood your problem yet, and I would encourage you to think about it some more. Okay, we'll pick it up next time.